didn't get finished last time, questions and discussions. Glad to have them again today. But whatever happens, we must finish with baptism and culture today. So that on Wednesday and on Friday, I can sum up the course a little around the themes that we have tried to analyze since the beginning of the course. So that on Wednesday and Friday, I can do some summarizing, which doesn't mean that you can't answer questions, if you like to as well. Now, I made clear last time, at least in the last minutes, that the relationship of fascism to culture is, of course, quite different in Italy and Germany. But that all fascism accepted the communications revolution, that they all accepted technology, and that even National Socialism made a distinction between technology and science, fully accepting technology and speed and dynamic, and indeed being obsessed with it. But science, again, coming into the racial ideas. And that the difference between the relative openness of Italy and the closed mind of Germany is the density of tradition. If you have racism, you have tradition. If you have racism, your elbow room for new things is much restricted, because racism directs you back into the past, into the mythical past history. Myth becomes all important. And if you do not have a racist idea in Italy, that is not quite the case. Moreover, as I said last time, in Italy, there were radical syndicalist currents which were absent in Germany. And finally, it does matter what sort of nationalism you have, because fascism is nationalism. All nationalism looks back to history. But it depends again on the density. And here you have German nationalism, dense, preoccupation ever since the Wars of Liberation against Napoleon. You have Italian nationalism of a different kind, which is a more nationalism with a human face, through Mazzini, through Italian traditions that I cannot go into now, through, in a way, the stronger Italian regionalism. And so, while in Germany, even, you have at first some openness, that is soon stopped. As I told you, even the National Socialists had an affinity for expressionism, and the expressionists had an affinity for National Socialism. The greatest expressionist poet in Germany, Gottfried Benn, became a National Socialist for 3 or 4 years, because the expressionists needed direction and clearness of literary form. Which they confused with authoritarian politics. It's very common that clearness of literary form is confused with authoritarian politics. T.S. Eliot made the same confusion, and so did Ezra Pound and Yeats. Very many modern writers believed in political authoritarianism because it would give them a hold and direction to their avant-garde and rather vague poetic ideals. But the Nazi students also had an affinity for expressionism, because expressionism was tales of soul. It was dynamic, but Hitler, with his banal taste, certainly believed that expressionism could never be integrated into the increasing emphasis on order in National Socialism, the increasing need to curb the activism. And just as the SA, so did the expressionists fall victim to this Nazi emphasis on order against the dynamic. Now, Mussolini had the same problem, but he never solved it that way. He solved the problem first through the corporate state, and secondly through the Ethiopian war, if you like, and certainly through the racial laws. In other words, Mussolini too had a series of maneuvers which distracted, which channeled the enthusiasm. which made it easier to keep law and order. But these maneuvers, whether the Ethiopian war or the corporate state or the racial laws, were partly failures because, as I told you, the second generation of fascist youth did revolt against fascism. But the avant-garde in Italy was never suppressed. Now, there's one thing, however, that stands outside. One cultural phenomena that, oddly enough, stands outside everything I've talked about, and that is music. For some reason, even in National Socialism, modern music flourished. Karl Orff, Carmina Burana of 1937, that famous piece by Karl Orff, modern music flourished, not 12-tone. That was Jewish music, because Schoenberg was Jewish. But any other avant-garde music that was not Jewish music, as a matter of fact, had a good reception in Nazi Germany or in Italy. Music stood outside fascist control. Now, why that is hypothetical. Perhaps we could say that it is so elitist that they didn't really have to bother about it, because who understands Carmina Burana? Today it's very popular, but then it was, after all, avant-garde. So that it is so elitist that nobody has to bother about it, that's one. These are all hypotheses, I have no idea. And after all, most modern composers, and oddly enough, even some Jewish composers who were accepted, had a kind of chic of incorporating folk music into their compositions. And that is true of Karl Orff in Germany, and it is true of Respighi and others in Italy. In fact, in Italy you have another phenomenon. You have a famous manifesto in the early days of fascism in 1925, signed by Donizetti, Respighi, and all the famous musicians praising fascism and confessing themselves for fascists. Now again, they did that partly the same reason that Ezra Pound and Yeats and so on were fascists, to get order, to get directions. Indeed, this fascist musical manifesto is signed by composers, in this case, who were more old-fashioned. Donizetti was an old man, a neo-romanticist. Respighi is a neo-romanticist, by then an old man as well. But this was the elite of the composers. As you know, Richard Strauss went with the Nazis, and not for musical reasons, because he was a weak character, personally, a personal failure. But never mind. What you have here is that music stands out. And whatever other remarks you make, in music, fascism makes very little difference for reasons that are by no means clear. But this enables me to make another remark. Some of the best minds, probably the best literary minds, were fascists. If you look at them all together, the fascist sympathizers, from T.S. Eliot to Yeats, to Ezra Pound, and you can go on, to the Bauhaus people, to Corbusier, to the modern architects, to the modern musicians, you will find, contrary to myth, that the avant-garde was very largely on the fascist side. And the reason that they were on the fascist side is, for them, fascism gave them order. Modern literature is formless, or what Ezra Pound called rightly a formless wobble. And Céline in France is another good example, by the way. There are many. The formless wobble, and fascism brought order in the formless wobble, without, as it were, without, in this case, constraining the writers. Because fascism really didn't care about Yeats' poetry or Pound's poetry, or, indeed, modern architecture a great deal. In Italy, it fitted in with a greater openness. Pound always said Mussolini his poems. Mussolini didn't understand them. I mean, he didn't care. Why should he bother? You see, who read Ezra Pound? Nobody did. So, from his point of view. So, these people had a certain freedom of fools, as we call it in Germany. Narrenfreiheit. Freedom of fools, yes? But there is, I think, another thing about that too, a greater openness in Italy, and it's Italian fascism they sympathize, not National Socialism. National Socialism was too German for them. It was Italian fascism that these best writers and authors symbolized, that became the archetype, because its greater openness and because it was not so provincial as Germany. Now, having said all this, I think it must be clear that in Italy, at any rate, the avant-garde went on. Terragni, the famous architect, built one of the most at the frontier of the architectural vanguard, which you can still see today, the famous fascist party building in the city of Como, sextagonal on the avant-garde of the Bauhaus. And indeed, I would say the famous Rome railway station, which some of you may know, is at the avant-garde of the Bauhaus. So obviously, there was very much of this. For example, the hall built for the 10th anniversary of the fascist revolution in 1932 was designed by Terragni, and it was dominated by a turbine. The thoughts and actions of Mussolini are like a turbine, taking the Italian people and making them fascist. So you see again, technology and fascism you have here. And the symbol of fascism was a turbine. You know what is a turbine? No, it makes electricity. So, anyway. So, what you have, it doesn't stand alone. For example, as late as 38, Kandinsky, the greatest of the modern abstract painters, had great praise for fascism. Kandinsky said, fascism's defense of abstract art, and the painter Bella, one of the main fascist painters, was very suitable for the wonderful new regime. The wonderful new regime was fascist. And of course, the new futurist painters, whose paintings are very good, nobody would deny, the futurist paintings, the Bauhaus architecture, all of those were given a great deal of freedom for people like Bottai held, typically enough, that fascism's use of the newest technology also meant fascism's use of the newest in art and literature. And here, of course, the futurist influences violently modern, anti-historical, assert themselves. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is they didn't have it to themselves. Indeed, even as Italian fascism went on, futurists asked the new architecture, all those who thought that fascism was also a literary and architectural revolution, were more and more pushed to the side. That begins in 1926, when nationalism's historical roots, and nationalism always looks backward. It's very difficult for nationalism, obviously, to look forward. So, the roots asserted themselves. The date is 1926. Mussolini orders the excavations of the ruins of Rome and their lighting at night. The next date is 1928, on the capital of Rome. That is the center of Rome, the Roman center, where those buildings are by Michelangelo. You probably know it. The capital of Rome, where you go down to the Forum, which is built entirely by Michelangelo, has a museum, always had a classical museum. This museum now becomes Museum Mussolini. The only museum to have Il Duce's name is now a museum of classics, which stands in the old capital of Rome, on the Capitol. The museum still exists, it's not on the Museum of Mussolini here. But whatever you have, therefore, here, you have all of these ideas. And you now get, under the guidance of Mussolini's mistress, who became sort of an arbiter of culture, Margheriti Sarfatti, his 20-year mistress, she was Jewish. In 1938, he sent her to Brazil with a lot of money, and she went into exile in Brazil. She then came back and died in Rome. In fact, when I was last in Rome, I had to give a big press conference, and I opened it by saying whether they had used this hotel because it is here that Margaritas, our first party, died. It wasn't very popular, never mind. Anyhow, Margarita Sarfati founded a group which became the great rival and eventually victorious, called the New Century, Novecento. And the Novecento group encouraged Roman revival, encouraged the linking up with the Roman Empire, which you can see today, to this day, when you come to the Roman Forum, look to the left, and you will see something that's never been eliminated in the new subway station which Mussolini built for the Roman subway to Ostia. There are maps. One map is of the Roman Empire, one map is of Italy as it was, and one map is of Italy as it should be, with Mediterranean as Mare Nostrum. You can see it today. Nobody bothered to take it off. And again, it was part of the Colosseum. It's on the Colosseum station of the Roman subway. So you have again this link, you see, of the classics. And indeed, the chief writers of the Novecento group termed themselves romantic realists. And here's a link of all fascism, because in Germany too, the Nazi writers called themselves romantic realists. And what they meant is very simple: realistic character portrayal in a romantic setting. That was Hitler's idea as well. Romanticism and realism, this kind of mixture, which really goes back to the neoclassicism of the end of the 19th century. It goes back to the neoclassical revival in Vienna and elsewhere, which formed Hitler's taste. Realism and romanticism, realistic character portrayal in a romantic setting. What the Germans called and Hitler called verklärte Wirklichkeit, luminous reality. Reality, but reality transcended through what? Through the nation, through fascism, obviously, yes? Reality transcended, that sort of an idea. And so you have paintings which are like German paintings, Nazi paintings, paintings of the Battle of Grain, Mussolini harvesting, people draining the marshes, people listening to a speech of Mussolini, just as you have German paintings, people listening to a speech of Hitler. This is what we call Soviet realism. It's all the same. Whether it's fascist realism or Soviet realism, it's identical. It's a kind of realism in a transcendent setting, transcendent through the object. It's really a continuation of sentimental romanticism, of the pictures that you see in your landlady's study today, of sentimental romanticism, these realistic landscapes with the sunsets and God knows what. This is all now a national idea. Now, it is clear, therefore, that fascism in Italy came to be ambivalent, very ambivalent. There was also another movement called Strapaese, which was, like Germany, a Völkisch movement. It glorified the peasants and peasant culture and all of this. But that was not so important as the classical revival. And Mussolini's ambition then became to join the great builders of Rome. His example was Pope Urban VIII. The Rome that you see today is the Rome of Pope Urban VIII of the 18th century. It's the Baroque Rome. And Mussolini wanted to be the successor of Urban VIII, and therefore he did these dreadful things. He put a road through to the Vatican. In the old days, when you came to St. Peter's, it was marvelous. By the way, the Israelis did the same mistake in Jerusalem. You need things for parades. Nationalism needs parades. And so Mussolini put a street through to the Vatican so that Bernini Square is utterly spoiled. In the old days, you came to Bernini Square from a slum, and so suddenly from a slum you came to this marvelous square. But Mussolini wanted to rebuild Rome, so all the dreadful things that you see in Rome today are all Mussolini's, but also, of course, the Roman ruins. And here, this asserted itself. The climax was the building of a stadium, the Forum Mussolini, in 1932. A forum to see 200,000 people surrounded by classical statues symbolizing bodily perfection. And here again I want to say that the stereotype with which we have been so much concerned is of course common to Italy and Germany. This classical stereotype, the ideal type of nationalism, which we have talked about so much, is in common. In Germany it's all about, and in Italy it's all about, and it is to this day, you can see it, in these figures which surround the forum, Mussolini. Again, it is clear and simple style, monumentalism. Again, the classics here, as in Germany, become monumentalism. And by that time in 1932, the Italian Architectural Association, which had earlier taken Mies van der Rohe and Le Corbusier as models, began to advocate monumentalism. In other words, more and more, the linking of fascism and avant-garde is pushed to the fringes of the movement. It's never vanished, but it becomes a fringe, and more nationalism asserts itself. That doesn't mean that there was not a conflict between Germany and Italy. The futurists always attacked the Nazis, for a photographic static. And it is very true that the futurists condemned the racist laws. When Mussolini introduced the racist laws in 1938, Marinetti and the futurists, Terragni and the architects, they all condemned the racist laws. For to them, the racist laws were part of conservatism, were part of the tradition asserting itself over, if you like, the avant-garde, over the new. And at the same time, the old was triumphant. The eclecticism, easily explained by something all of you have seen if you've ever been in Rome. When you come to Rome to the airport, you see, as you make a very, very 90 degree turn into the traffic jam, just before you get into the traffic jam, you see a new city, which is called Rome Euro, a whole new city, which Mussolini built. And he built it to celebrate the 20th anniversary in 1942, the war. A whole new part of Rome, dominated by a Catholic basilica. And it still stands. It's called Rome Euro. You all think it stands for Europe. It doesn't stand for Europe. It stands actually for the fascist anniversary. And it's still, but they left the name because everybody now thinks it stands for Europe. Never mind. Anyhow, if you look at it, you get a shock. There's nothing modern about it. It's totally eclectic. It has every kind of architecture of the Italian past. Neo-Renaissance, neo-Baroque, neo-Romanesque. In fact, the big basilica, which you'll see as you come from the airport, which dominates Rome oil, is in fact neo-Romanesque. But the rest is neo-this, neo-that. It's totally eclectic. And by 1942, there is no doubt that modernism, the avant-garde, was in retreat, and yet not totally. In the middle of it, there is one building which Terragni designed, which is of Bauhaus style. One building is still one of Bauhaus style. Now there is the Italian Veterans Organization. I've worked in it a lot. There's the Italian War Veterans Organization in it. But it is still one building of Bauhaus style is left, but it shows you what was happening. Now, obviously, the conflict between the ancients and moderns in fascism very clearly is several things. It is a search for clarity. No doubt the modern appealed to fascism because of its clear lines. Just as fascism appealed to all these writers, the best minds, the most important writers, poets. Above all, poets, fascism appeals. Not, by the way, and this I must say too, because fascism rather than communism had a place for the poet. That appealed to Ezra Pound and others too, because fascism with its symbolism, the poet could design, the best artist designed some of the props for fascist marches and mass movements. Theatrical design was great in fascism because theatrical design left the theater and came into the piazza or into the square, and was the design, after all, of the fascist mass movement. So theatrical designers had suddenly a political function they never had before. But so had poets. After all, D'Annunzio, who is the kind of archetype for that, was a poet who tried out all these new mass movement ideas. In Fiume, as I have told you before, that you can read in the Culture of Western Europe. So D'Annunzio showed how the poet had a place in mass movements, how suddenly the artist had a place. That's a great thing. It shouldn't be so strange to you, you little intellectual. You all want to join the working class, and it doesn't work. The workers suddenly find out who you really are. So they beat you over the head. So it doesn't work. So all intellectuals want to join some mass movement, have some political function. Look how they joined into the communist Kennedy administration. Who makes the myth of John Kennedy in America? The intellectuals, and it is a myth. The intellectuals, why do they make a myth of President Kennedy? Because for once he gave them a place. Nobody else has given them a place, very easy. So you have it there, see? That's why it's good to give intellectuals a place. You can be sure of the myth. What will happen, I mean it seriously, if I were president, first thing I'd do. So, the failures are all forgotten. So, what you have, therefore, is suddenly fascists gave the artists a place. I mean, Ezra Pound, you know, suddenly in England he was nothing. In Italy, he was a lord. He never got anywhere because Mussolini thought he was a screwball. But still he was received, he got orders of decoration, that sort of stuff. You know, they all made hymns for fascism, and sometimes just to be nice, somebody sang them, and they thought they had a place. But all I want to make clear to you is that fascism gave the artists a place. But for fascism itself, of course, the important thing was the clear lines, the authoritarianism, that is, in the search for clarity, the search for clarity, and dynamic, Well, the avant-garde, the modern avant-garde, in a way, stood for that. But above all, technology. What was more clean line, in a way, dynamic than the airplane? There was an intellectual reason for the turbine and the airplane and all of this kind of thing, which again appealed to the futurists. After all, the futurists had exalted, remember, the sports car. That was, after all, their great thing. You mustn't forget. Moreover, from the point of view of fascism, the avant-garde brought it abreast of things. Now, Mussolini was a man of the world. He wanted to be abreast of things. He wanted to be a modern man. Hitler never had that hang-up. He was a little provincial. He didn't know what it meant to be a modern man. He had no ambitions of this nature. He said, so what? This is uninteresting. But Mussolini, who wrote plays, don't forget, bad plays, but he wrote plays. Mussolini, who himself wrote plays, who thought he was a poet of sorts, is a different matter. He was a man of the world. He had once been a socialist. Mussolini had hobnobbed with the most interesting things. He had been a friend of Rosa Luxemburg. He had known Lenin. Hitler was a little provincial. He hadn't known anybody. There's a great difference, you mustn't forget, between the two. That's why they hated each other. They could never understand each other. They're totally different. And yet, of course, fascism, as I hope I have made clear, is a common movement, in spite of this difference. It's a common movement. But the difference makes for a change in cultural attitudes. In other words, Mussolini was more tolerant of the avant-garde. Hitler knew architecture, but he knew the wrong architecture. He was enamored with the architecture of the neoclassical period, the Vienna of his youth, all of that sort of thing, and not with modern architecture. And Hitler never changed. Mussolini was quite different. So we must not really forget that, that there is more room for these ideas. But we must also remember that these things are, after all, relative. In the end, I think National Socialism strangled anything new. The anti-bourgeois revolution, from which modern art and architecture comes, let me make that clear again, because it sort of summarizes much what we've done. The anti-bourgeois-bourgeois revolution of the end of the century, from which modern art and architecture so largely derived, of which you must be quite clear now, was accepted by the Nazis only in politics, only as rhetoric, but not in culture. Was accepted by the Nazis in technology, but not in culture. So you get that mixture of the beauty of work, which you read about and which I talked about. So then we must say for the Nazis, it was cultural retrogression. Not technological retrogression, no. Not retrogression in improving working conditions, in modernization. Not at all, not at all. Many of the Nazis' economic forms have survived very strongly, above all this nationalization of steel, yes? And still today, the biggest German steel works, Salzgitter, the Hermann Göring works, they were called, and today the Salzgitter. Very much of this survived, but culturally speaking, a retrogression into provincialism. No doubt, a retrogression into provincialism. That the art, the literature of National Socialism, nobody would read today anymore. It has not lasted, except on the popular level. It is popular literature, it never changed. It simply adopted what had always been popular literature. The Cinderella story, you see that in your Nazi culture. The Cinderella story, and Cinderella simply becomes an Aryan girl. But it's still the same Cinderella story, no matter what you make out of it, yes? And the same kind of sentimentality of popular culture. That, of course, remains, but that comes to us from the 1880s at latest, and the Nazis simply annexed it, but there's nothing modern that you can say has lasted from the Nazis. Nazis painting and Nazi art, which is like Soviet art, later Soviet art, would have no successors, really, and the artists are now forgotten. You can look in the pictures in Nazi culture to bring it home to you. These Ziegler nudes, of Ziegler, the famous Nazi artist, known commonly as the master of the pubic hair. If you look at his figures, one of whom I reproduce, which Hitler liked so much, that today is forgotten. That today is forgotten. But in fascism in Italy, it is different. And in fascism, where it is only an intellectual coterie, it is different altogether. The fascism in Italy, to a certain extent, transmitted avant-garde ideas, even added to them. The futurist painters of the fascist times are very popular. There is, at this moment when I'm speaking, a big exhibition of futurist painters in New York. I'm just about to buy one. Of futurist painters in New York, for example. So that, of course, has lasted, yes? Some of the frontiers of architecture has lasted in spite of its beleaguered state as fascism evolved. And in France, where fascism was only an intellectual coterie, where the nationalism was thin, where these young Frenchmen came to fascism as a dynamic, as a Nietzschean in Lyon, a little bit of racism, a little bit of nationalism, but that wasn't really important. They became fascist because it was fun, it was the politics of joy. Those people have lost. Today in France, Brassillard, Céline, Drouin-La Rochelle, these people you can buy today, they have lasted in French literature. You can ask Anglaise in our French department who writes about them, they have lasted. So the final question is again a question that I want to come back to, the density of nationalism. Is what matters. And wherever fascism, like in Germany, was so provincial, so racist, racism can never make an alliance with avant-garde. Nationalism can, under certain circumstances, and did in Italy. There is a difference there. And where fascism wasn't at all allied with nationalism, and therefore didn't have to bother with history, didn't have a complex about the old Germans or the old Celts or God knows what. There, of course, it could be playful. It could be almost anything, because there it sort of worshipped a dynamic. It really became a kind of Nietzschean, a way to be a Nietzschean man, and a way not to be a hypocrite, a way to be honest, to be Nietzschean, to enjoy life. There it really became for these young people a policy of joy. But with all of this, never forget the common basis of fashion. The basis is, of course, dictatorship. The basis is, of course, the anti-bourgeois revolution. That is why I said last time, you weren't here, but in answer to the question you asked, that it is, of course, a European movement. I mean, that must be clear, and as I said last time, I assumed, because it's, of course, in European culture that this is what it was. It is part of the anti-bourgeois revolution, which is a European phenomenon. It is, after all, a dynamic, the same dynamic we've studied. And it is, of course, law and order. It tries to have both in modern times. Always fascism tries to have both. Law and order and dynamic. That's what you all want. You want law and order and you want a dynamic. You want to be the spoiled bourgeois children of Fox Point. You want to play without punishment. That's what people want, and that's what fascism gives you. It gives you a dynamic and law and order. Playtime. And it gives you something else as well, not just dynamic and law and order. It gives you a feeling of political participation through its mass politics and its acceptance of the new politics. I haven't said anything about it because you read about it. The new politics, the new mass politics. So it gives you a sense of dignity and participation. It does that through mass politics, through uniforms, through making you feel important, through making you feel important, through participation. It gives you, in other words, what I call a fully furnished house. That socialism couldn't do for many reasons. Too much rationalism, it's too one class, it's too rationalistic, it's too one class, and all of this sort of thing. It couldn't give, but fascism could, and in fact did. And finally, in all of this, fascism gives you, I think, a sense of being extraordinary, a sense of festival. Remember how much we talked about the sense of festival, the longing for this festival, even within normalcy, even within normalcy. And I would put it this way, the tolerance of the avant-garde in fascism is like the tolerance of the Baron Charlus in Proust, or Swan in Proust. That is to say, fascism imitates existing society. These things are tolerated as long as they are eccentric. In other words, you have in fascism writ large something that I think is basic of our society, not only of our society, of all settled society. This, I think, could be basic for the third world, all settled society, that there is a definition of normals, and that the abnormal is tolerated as long as it is eccentric. When it becomes more than eccentric, political, powerful or not, it is not tolerated. And that was, of course, Proust's great insight in Remembrance of Times Past, where he has the homosexual Charlus, for example, and Swan himself, the Jew, and for Proust, and I think this is true for Italian fascism, for all modern society, the Jew, the homosexual, the lesbian, are all in the same pot. In other words, they're all tolerated as long as they are amusing, but in the black. Once they are no longer amusing, they are no longer tolerated. Then, if they make alliances with important other groups in society, and they become a menace, you will soon see that they are no longer tolerated. And I think fascism and the avant-garde has the same relationship. That Mussolini, these things were tolerated as long as they were amusing and eccentric. But once they were no longer amusing or eccentric, once they became a problem in Mussolini's alliance with Hitler, a problem in keeping the dynamic going, a problem because the young fascists revolted, a problem because avant-garde might reactivate the activism. So it became a problem. Then it was slowly but surely squashed. So that fascism is the climax of normalcy in our time. It is the climax of middle class morals and manners. It is the climax of the middle class. There is no two ways about it, because it protected middle class norms, manners, and morals. There is no way about it. The ideal types of fascism is the ideal type that we've always talked about, the clean-cut American, the clean-cut Englishman, the clean-cut no matter what. Yes? The ideal type of woman is the ideal type of woman, the mother and wife. Yes? The ideal type of beauty is the Greek ideal type of beauty. And that is the last strength of fascism. It would not have worked, nothing worked, if it doesn't have tradition. And fascism had a lively tradition, and it activated that tradition. It activated that tradition, and in the last resort, it was built upon the stereotype. This is true in Italy, which was not racist, where this a Jew could be that stereotype, not a black against black. Italy became racist. The Abyssinian War is the foreshadower of the racist laws. In other words, there's a direct relation of racism against the Abyssinians and racism against the Jews. The Abyssinian War is a forerunner of the 1938 racist laws, and there's no doubt about it. But in Germany, it is clear. The Aryan is Winckelmann's Greek sculpture. The Aryan is an ideal type who had been an ideal type for a hell of a long time, for over 100 years, as we have seen. So there was nothing new. And in fact, the matter of eccentricity and of tolerating the abnormal in a normal society has to do with people's suspicion of the new. That's a general trait, don't tell me different. The suspicion of the new. That people don't want a journey into the blue yonder. They don't want the new. But still they want excitement. Excitement. So what Star Trek is to you, fascism was to millions. And I mean that literally, as it combines all of these. What Star Trek is to you, fascism was to millions. Because it appeared in the last resort to a certain rhythm of human nature, of humanity, a rhythm I think that we have seen all along in one song. And a rhythm that people wanted to get out of. They wanted to get out of this bind. Those socialists who built on the goodness of human nature and human reason. In other words, the opposite of that rhythm, of which fascism and Star Trek and rock concerts and God knows what are so typical. The opposite of that, which is always on the losing end, in my opinion, is reason on the one hand. Man as predominantly reason, which is a socialist idea, above all incorporated in socialism. And the second idea is man as good, as basically good, which is also the idea of those socialists that we have talked about who wanted to get away from Marxist orthodoxy. But I think it is typical, and here I know I'm going to come into difficulty again with some of you, that wherever socialism has been realized, it has gone the fascist way. Wherever Bolshevism, has been realized in Eastern Europe, it has gone the fascist way. But what is nearer to fascism in culture than East Germany or Eastern Europe, I simply do not know. It is almost identical in its petty bourgeois outlook, in its provincialism. And that is true for East Germany again more than for Poland and others, because it depends on the density of control. It depends on how dictatorial these regimes are. But there is no question that wherever Bolshevism has come to power, it has culturally gone the fascist way. Clarity and complicatedness, all of this, the family, all of these ideas, you will find there almost a textbook kind of revival. This does not mean, finally, that I think fascism is alive. History never repeats itself. But there are bits and pieces which are taken and put together. I disagree with what I wrote you last time, read to you last time about Seton Watson, who believes there is fascism in the Third World because they are dictators and they are one-party regimes. Be very careful not to judge fascism from parliamentary government. Be very careful not to judge every regime from the heights of parliamentary government, a system of government that has never survived a crisis. It's ridiculous to judge the world by parliamentary government. It is ridiculous and propagandistic to do that. It has never survived anything. But you must be careful. But as far as Europe is concerned, there are bits and pieces, and the cultural bits and pieces are the easiest to put again into place. So that I would say, finally, as far as fascism is concerned, and before we sum up next time, and I'll again begin with asking for questions next time, before we do that, I want to make clear that, after all, finally, as far as fascism is concerned, the cultural is again today in place in Eastern Europe. And it isn't, unfortunately, the culture of Italian fascism, but the culture of National Socialism. Why? Because of nationalism. Communism has to legitimize itself through nationalism. That's how communism thinks it must legitimize itself, where it is in power. Therefore, communism becomes the new nationalism. The new nationalism, the Traditionspflege, as they say in the DDR. That is to say, you further tradition. East Germany is the only place in the world today where people still make pilgrimages to national monuments, where you still have novels where they are exalting old times. Poland is the only nation in the world where after the war, the communists, rather than feeding their old population, spent millions in rebuilding old Poland, which is a remarkable phenomenon. So, communism's legitimacy is nationalism. And therefore, what you actually get is, that is the inheritor of this culture. Because basically, the culture we talked about is a culture that is based on the middle classes. Yes, based on middle class values, and based on nationalism above all. And that is now very much with us as a legitimizing function for communist regimes in Eastern Europe. So you can't say all of fascism is dead, but the way you kids use fascism is, of course, makes it meaningless and makes it not dangerous. The way I object to your use of fascism, many of you use it, you drew the string. That's why I object to your use of racism. If you use fascism and racism for everybody you dislike, which you have to do, then you draw the string, then you don't make them as dangerous as they are. Then you don't make them as important than you are. You trivialize racism and fascism by using it against people who are by no means fascist and by no means really racist. So all these things become trivialized, I realize, like liberalism, like even socialism, is today trivialized. But I think we must be very careful, because racism is, of course, very much with us. The real thing, I don't mean the trivial thing, is very real with us, and of course, fascism is very much with us in bits and pieces, and above all, in the constant cultural pull of nationalism. So I would say this, and I would sum up next time, but I would say this in the end, finally, that wherever you have nationalism, you have the risk, the high risk of racism and fascism, certainly in cultural terms. Even if there doesn't have to be Mussolini, because I leave you with the last thought of a man who knew what he was talking about, Huey Long. Huey Long once said the truest thing, that if fascism comes to America, it will come under the guise of anti-fascism. I think that's true. I think that's very true. Well, I'll sum up next time.